all the wayward wind is a restless wind.
Good morning and welcome to our first show on Downtown Crosswords. This is Ed Rosenthal, poet, broker, and desert survivor. Just a little bit about me. I've been involved downtown in real estate since the 1980s when the Reagan building was under construction. And I pretty much specialize in the area where that building's located. Main Street, Spring Street, and Broadway, where all the activities taking place downtown. There's a real transformation here, and there's a lot of issues involved. I want to welcome our first guest, Sandy Richards, Reverend of the First United Methodist Church downtown, and we'll get to her in a minute. Just want to establish a context of the show. We're starting the show out with our first broadcast the day after these verdict in the Trayvon Martin fiasco, I guess I'd call it, the George Zimmerman trial. We're broadcasting to you from California. This is a state with a excess prison population. The government is under a court order to release a number of prisoners from the jail, and there's quite a to-do over that. We're broadcasting to you from Los Angeles, a city impacted by every global current you can think of, and it's on its way to bankruptcy unless it handles its pension issue with the city workers. And we're coming again from downtown L.A., a really exciting place with a lot of changes going on, and I'm broadcasting from Olive Street. And this is a place where I sold a building years ago. The landlord made $7 million and still didn't want to pay the commission. Anyway, let's get started with our first guest, Sandy Richards. Welcome, Sandy.
Hey, Ed. Great to be here.
Thanks so much. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of First United Methodist Church here in downtown? Take all the time you like.
Yep, we have an hour. So it's, first of all, it's really great to be here and to be your inaugural guest.
Thank you.
I love downtown. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, and downtown and I have kind of grown up together over the last half century. And it is just a pleasure to be sitting across from you, one of my favorite downtown LA people. And,
wow.
And on behalf of downtown, thanks for doing this show. I think it's going to become a great forum for us here in this urban core as we move, you know, through all of our changes.
Well, thanks so much. We'll try to get to the root of things rather than just the same old analysis.
Yeah, we need some alternate forums. We have lots of forums, but this is a great one, and thank you. So, so First Methodist Church was actually born in 1854 when most of the streets were unpaved and it was a little bit wild and woolly in this part of the world. And the place that is now Plaza Olvera, there was a bar called the El Dorado Saloon. And Adam Bland and his wife, I think her name was Emily, they were Methodists and he was a pastor. And they came and did church services there. And they also started a school for girls. So I like to say that that was the first adaptive reuse project in the modern era, that the Methodists had the first adaptive reuse project. And that's where the Pico House is now, I think.
That's right.
Is where that was.
Do people associate that area more with the Hispanic or Latino population?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that the church originated there.
Well, that was the first place that there was a known Methodist worship service in downtown. And our church traces its roots back as First Methodist Church. We are sort of the mother church of the Los Angeles area. We are the first United Methodist Church in Los Angeles. And we've had spots all around downtown. We were where Grand Central Market is now, when it was Fort Street. We were the Fort Street Methodist Episcopal Church. Then they changed it to First Methodist Episcopal Church. That's the old-fashioned name for our denomination. And then we just have been everywhere. We were at 8th and Hope. Preservationists are still lamenting the loss of the beautiful church that was built in the 20s that was there. And we are now in South Park neighborhood at Flower and Olympic. We own land there, We had a church building. It was torn down in 03. And so we've been on an exodus, so to speak, in between buildings. But we're a church that remains vital in downtown and part of a Methodist network of churches. You mentioned Plaza Olvera. And I'd like to say a word about the La Plaza Methodist Church. The Methodists have been on Plaza Olvera since the 1800s. And at about the turn of the last century, we began to coalesce, to work on the issues there that are still issues, immigration, people driven by war, driven north from Mexico, driven from the Philippines, driven from China, or brought from China to work. So the Filipinos, the Chinese, and the Mexican people who immigrated were all congregating in that area. And the Catholic Church was there, and the Methodist Church was there. And in the 20s, I understand, there was an outbreak of bubonic plague, even. Like, the situation was dire there. And people were very sick, and they were sleeping outside. There was open sewage. And so the network of Methodist churches around Los Angeles were part of the group that pressured the city hall to make sure that the infrastructure being built as the city moved west toward the beach was also built in downtown in that area so that, they could overcome the issues that were there. And we brought Goodwill Industries in as a way to give people jobs and also access to affordable things. And the thing we're the most proud of, and you can see this if you go to the La Plaza Methodist Church right now, it's right there on the plaza, is a fountain. We had a drinking fountain. And behind it was a sign, and this was in the teens and 20s. There was a big sign that said, "You are welcome to drink from this fountain." And I can't tell you how many people had their pictures taken in front of that fountain. Just almost anyone who had a camera and had and could take a photograph had a picture taken. All races, all colors of people, all ages, people holding babies, nurses, missionaries, and finally the Latino pastors who began to come through the Methodist Church and lead the people there.
Let me just ask you something about that area. I recently went there. There was a demonstration at Pico House against the drug war, and it was mainly participants from Mexico, and they were making the argument that it's really Mexico that suffers from the drug war, and it's really something that never works, and there's been examples throughout history of a failure of these prohibition. Does your church have any connection with those people that are opposing the drug war? And if so, can you tell us about that?
Well, in the official United Methodist Church is a transnational church. It's global. And so we have colleagues all around the globe who bring us the news of how U.S. policies impact them wherever they are. This particular issue, this particular demonstration, I was not a part of and not aware of. But one of the things that I have been investigating and am at work in a larger group of people, not just Methodists, but interfaith communities, is the impact of these so-called drug wars on women and children. Because in effect, what happens is we militarize people's homes and villages and towns. And so rather than trying to... I think we want to get rid of the effects of drug use in our societies, and we want to make sure that, you know, there's a lot of profit made off of drugs by people that you really don't necessarily want to have a lot of money, right? That, you know, obviously gangs and cartels, and these are words we know about. But I'm not sure people understand that by having a solely militaristic way of looking at it, which is when we say war on drugs, when we look at it as crime and punishment and as eradication by arms, by means of arms and violence, we're actually putting at risk the women and children and the young people who grow up to be men, young boys and girls and their parents. We really have created much more of an impact in violence and than we have resolved.
So what do you think about this wall that people are advocating be built in the south of the U.S. and all the money they intend to spend on security?
You know, I feel like I'm not an expert on this. I have an opinion, but I'll tell you what my opinion is. My opinion is that if we want to stop people from trying to come to our country illegally, that the most important thing isn't to erect a barrier. to try to keep people from crossing the border. Because I think it's impossible. We'll build a border all the way across, you know, we could build a border all the way across the natural boundaries of Mexico and the U.S. and have a big wall and have it patrolled and electrified and what have you. We could put, you know, even landmines down. But the fact remains, if you want to come to Los Angeles, you can come to Los Angeles in every possible way that human beings get transported around the world. And human trafficking and so forth is not beaten by a wall. You might stop people trying to run across the border, but the reality is people don't want to leave their homes. They'd rather have living wages. They'd rather have a decent life. They'd rather live where they are and have what they need. So in a way, you could say that the drug war and the wall are related in this way, that if you are living in a war zone, you want to leave and you want to go somewhere you believe is peaceful and wonderful. And of course, the U.S., primarily most of us, live our lives in relative peace and in relative comfort in this country compared to some of the other places in the world. So I could see how if, you know, we really need to look at our practices in this country and look at the ways other people live in other countries and see if we can't help people live in peace and in decent conditions where they live.
Thank you so much. You know, personally, I think it's all driven by economics, and I think security contractors and others of that ilk are promoting this wall and promoting all the expenditure on this approach, which doesn't work. But let's get back to your church. What's your mission worldwide? And if you could tell us how First United Methodist Church's mission differs from other churches we might be familiar with, or just tell us yourself about what the church does worldwide.
Right. Well, as a denomination, the Methodist Church, We have our sort of marching orders, which is we say that we want to make disciples for Jesus Christ, meaning that not just converts, but as people of faith, we want to grow in our faith. We want to eradicate diseases of poverty. That's one of our mission statements. And one of the other ones is ministry with the poor. I think that's very, very important to say, not for the poor or to the poor. And even the phrase the poor can be problematic because it labels human beings. So if respect means that we believe people have the resources they need to meet their own needs, then in an atmosphere of mutual respect, we want to do all we can to make sure that everybody is living the fullness of life that we believe that Jesus Christ came to give us. And we are a Christian denomination, although we are not a creedal church. And what I mean by that is we have a lot of people who are Methodist who aren't necessarily as orthodox of Christians. You're allowed to question. We have a lot of doubt and a lot of lively conversations. There's a joke about us that there's not an opinion we don't lack. So any opinion is welcome. And we have quite a challenge, as you can imagine. The arguments and discussions that happen in the national discourse are happening in our church as well. So there's no test. In other words, everyone is welcome.
That's wonderful. It sounds like the community I'm a part of, Jews, they say you take two Jews and you get 10 opinions.
Yeah, I think we might just have two opinions in the Methodist Church, but I understand that about Jewishness.
How does your congregation fit into the structure, the national structure of the church?
We are an interesting, we're in transition right now, our church. We were once in the 1940s and 50s, we were the largest Protestant congregation west of the Mississippi. That is quite a statement. But as the 60s came and the suburbanization of California happened, people moved out of the urban core and into these other communities. And so from about the 50s until even now, there's been this sort of slide in numbers. But I think being without a building has challenged us to find new ways to be connected to the neighborhoods and to downtown. And so that's been a great challenge for us. And what we noticed as we've been, you know, out and we borrow space, we rent space, we work closely with 1010 Development Corporation, which the church founded, one of the many over the last 150 plus years or so, 140 years, I guess, since we were founded. we've founded many institutions, including some you've heard of, like University of Southern California, perhaps you've heard of.
I think I've heard of that.
Heard of it. So it was started by the Methodists. The first president of the university left the pulpit of First Methodist Church and became, he was a pastor and he became the first president there. So that's in our DNA, starting things, founding things, seeing what's needed and going for it.
Well, he did a good job. The real estate industry is totally dominated by USC.
It is, isn't it?
Especially corporate real estate.
Well, to be honest, it's long ago gone out on its own. I think it was the 1960s. There was a break from the denomination, and probably that was best for both parties. But it was founded by Methodists. And my point just being that we've stayed in that DNA. 1010 Development Corporation is a nonprofit housing corporation that was founded through First United Methodist Church and using the resources of the church. So when we hear developers say they can't afford to do affordable housing, we just we say we don't believe you, because we're a church and we don't even have a profit stream, and we did it, so we know you can if you want to. Now, you're not going to make the kind of profit you would make. And for-profit developers, we understand that's a different animal, but we know it can be done, and so and we did it. And the people and the pastors, in a string of pastors, were dedicated to that. So
you have a room available for the community, so I didn't quite understand. You're still active in the community, in that Los Flores Community Center?
The Villa Flores. So that is actually... So we worship in Villa Flores, which is, we meet on Sunday mornings. That is the affordable housing for seniors. The church does not own that. That's 1010 Development Corporation's Villa Flores. And they do allow us the use of the space. And we partner together, which is the point. So 1010 Development Corporation also has on Hope Street, they have Hope Village, which is family affordable housing. And on Flower, it's senior affordable housing. And they're really nice-looking developments, both of them. They're beautiful. And there's lots of kids. So we started a program for kids called Kid City with our partner organization, the Urban Foundation, which is also something the church founded. And it exists to kind of bring hope to the cities, to fund these small programs that large foundations don't fund. So we started Kid City. It started with 5 kids in Christmas of 2008, and now... This summer, there are 75 kids in the program.
That's wonderful. I've seen some of those kids at your church.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the church involves the youth that are members in worldwide? Some of the missions they've been on are very fascinating to me.
Right. So we work closely with people all around the globe. And right now, we have a mission team attending a human rights conference in the Philippines, as well as doing a medical mission to the south of the Philippines with the indigenous people who are fighting for their land rights. You mentioned the war on drugs, and I spoke of the militarism, and part of what happens is the militarized zones, particularly in the Philippines, it's also in South America, Central America, Africa, parts of the U.S., we see this, that corporations want to... have the land that the indigenous people, that is the indigenous people's ancestral lands. And so, but they're pristine, they're untouched. So they have gold, sweet crude, beautiful forests. So it looks like, you know, people would like to mine and, drill for oil, et cetera. And it's very lucrative, billions of dollars worth of gold and oil and so forth. So it's become incumbent upon the people who care about people to stand up and say the indigenous people should keep their land, and they should be able to do sustainable harvesting of trees if they want to sell lumber, or if they want to mine gold for the sake of their people, they should be given sustainable practices and be able to do it on their own behalf. They should own what's beneath them. So the problem is that they've been on these lands for thousands of years and they don't have a deed. They didn't have a deed to the land. So it just becomes...
Wow, that doesn't work in L.A.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point. Like, if there was an indigenous person who had land, they would long ago have lost it. So I think that's our... In the Methodist Church, we, in the Americas, the Methodist Church is heir to quite a bit of... let's say, dastardly deeds against Native Americans, including a place called Sand Creek, where a United Methodist pastor and general in the army attacked a group of Indigenous Americans, and there was a slaughter. And so this past year at our global meeting, we performed what we called an act of repentance, where we apologized, we acknowledged and apologized the degradation and the oppression done by the institutional church toward the Indigenous peoples of the Americas, primarily of the United States of America, primarily. However, that was just a sort of brush of the tip of the iceberg. We have a long way to go to really understand what our legacy is and how to repent, which is Christian language, meaning we're so sorry we did this and we'll never do it again. Well, of course, we are doing it again and again by participating in a global economy that demands these resources. So well, part
do you
of
work in conjunction with Rainforest Action Network and Cultural Survival and groups like that?
We don't. We are working with the more grassroots groups. So there are groups whose names you wouldn't know, but they are on the ground in the Philippines. So we're a small kind of group, and they're small groups. And so I think there will come a point, perhaps, when we work with the overall groups. But they're looking at the big picture and public policy advocacy and so forth, the groups you mentioned. We're working with the people on the ground to say, what do you need and what can we do for you? We're not showing up with the answer. We're showing up with a lot of questions and learning, and they're giving us the resources to teach us. For instance, last August, we were in Davao. I got to go last year. I didn't get to go this year. So the team is there now without me, but I'm watching Facebook and sending greetings to all our friends. But there's a peoples in the south of the Philippines called the Manobo peoples. And we were in their school, one of their schools, where their children are educated. We were there for 4 days. And when we left, there was hardly a drop of water. We drank all their water. They don't have trash. Everything they do is, biodegradable, and they don't have wrappers and whatever. And we brought in food with wrappers and trash. So we did, that was what we made a big impact upon them. But they welcomed us in order to help us understand their situation and teach us more about their struggles. And we are supporting their schools now.
It takes a lot of courage to even get involved there. I mean, 50 people were murdered in a recent election just for participating
on
Mindanao.
We think it's more important for us to be there because as white, particularly the white ones of us, like I'm a giant white woman. Radio people probably can't see, but I'm 6 feet tall and I'm a big white lady. And so I think that I'm perhaps one of the most safe people in the Philippines. As a church, as a religious leader, we come in the name of the Methodist Church, and we have the full faith and credit of the global church and white privilege. It goes a long way. It's a good use of white privilege to kind of be present. The unfortunate thing is that as we left, we knew that the military would come in and interrogate people and ask what they had told us, and we knew that it would be hard on the children and the women, particularly. I spoke about the militarism. They are often in the midst of exercises. They're called training exercises, but they use live ammunition, and it's the U.S. Army and the Philippine Armed Forces of the Philippines. And it's really a challenge as an American to see, to hear the story of a woman who had to leave her crops behind. They're a subsistence culture. The women work hard and till the soil. They have many children because they don't have access to birth control, and so they have to feed all these children. And when they have to, some of them mentioned that they had to leave without even grabbing their cook pot, which, you can't even cook if you don't have a cook pot. So they had to run for 3 months, leave their crops. And just these kinds of stories are awful, and you think, well, what is so important? There's approximately 2,000 people who are part of the armed forces, or are part of the People's Army, the so-called rebel army in the Philippines. And there are thousands and thousands of people in the armed forces of the Philippines fighting these so-called 2,000. So this gives me the opportunity to say that in the Philippines, there's a peace process, and the government just walked away from it. So what we can do as people of faith besides the awareness of how other people live, is that, or it's anyone, people of care, people who care, is to pressure the Philippine government to come back to the peace talks, because that's the only way. That, you know, nobody wants the fighting. Everybody wants the fighting to stop.
That sounds like a great idea. We're going to have Sandy back here on future shows as we search for a deep context on this downtown crossroads to what's impacting our lives. And so I just want to ask you now, how about downtown? Are there activities like this that you're involved with in downtown where you're pursuing a progressive agenda?
Sure, but first let's do this, because this is Ed's first show, but we want people to call in. If you're listening and you have questions or comments, you should call 1-800-893-9562. That's 800-893-9562, and you would be Ed's first caller.
Well, thanks so much.
You've got to get in the habit of saying the number. Yeah, so Kid City, I mentioned. Kid City is one of an. There are other organizations that are doing kids programs in downtown, and they're all full. But we think that the future of downtown has to do with the future of kids, which is not to say that people who are in family groups that don't have children, you know, we have lots of people in our church who are not married or don't have children of their own. But we think that it's what we do for the kids. That's our particular First Methodist Church's current focus. So we're putting our resources toward Kid City, as I mentioned, which meets at Hope Village. And I'm going to plug away on August 10th on the corner of Flower and Olympic in what is now our parking lot. Our church parking lot will hopefully become a church building sometime in the near future. They will have a big family festival, and we hope you'll come. August 10th, Kid Cities. It's called Splash of LA. It's the third annual Splash of LA, and it's going to be great for kids. And the monies all go to college scholarships for the kids that are going to college this fall.
Well, that sounds great. I know Hal Bastian has told me he spent years already trying to get a school set up downtown, mm-hmm. and you run into a lot of code-related difficulties.
Yes,
a lot of obstacles to having that happen.
Yeah. We found that with a daycare. We were looking to move a childcare years ago, and there's lots and lots of codes. You need huge play yards is the problem, and I think that's probably the issue with the school too. But there is a downtown charter was started by a lot of parents in South Park, and they are working very hard. So we're not involved directly with that, but we're a supporter of it, and we wrote a letter saying this is a great idea, and we hope that people will get involved in that. And we also hope that people will get involved with the schools that maybe aren't the public schools that maybe aren't up to speed for people who want kids in a good public school, but the public schools that surround downtown, could
like 9th Street School.
9th Street, 10th Street School, which we know 10th Street School, we know how old that is, because 10th became Olympic in what, the 1930s.
Wow.
So that school was founded probably just, I don't know when. But I think, you know, and there's Leo Pulido School. There's lots of schools that are near downtown that I think if a community chose to adopt those schools, we could raise the quality of the public schools. That's just my opinion. But the church itself is involved. We've got kids in music programs, and we've got kids in college-bound programs, writing programs. These are the kinds of things we're doing for the kids in the Kid City program to help them, because we know that that with coaching and collaboration, they learn leadership skills, they learn conflict resolution, and most important to us, they learn how to be citizens. They're not sitting around just playing their Xboxes. They're saying to themselves, this bothers me and I can do something about it. I have a voice in my community. I am a leader by taking responsibility for the things I care about and making a difference. And so we're seeing these kids go off to college, and this will be our third year of sending kids to college. In the first 2 years, every one of those kids makes a big impact in their colleges. We've seen them receive from their associated student bodies. They've been elected presidents of service organizations. They've been given awards. They go out with nothing more than the support. They're doing what they want to do. They just know that they can. And that's the big difference. All of us want to make a difference, but we don't think we can. These kids already know they can, and they know how to organize people. They know how to get people together toward a goal and work as a community. And I think that's really our overall mission in the First Methodist Church. Obviously, we're a Christian church. We worship a particular way, but we see that our neighborhood obligation is to make our neighborhood better as best we can, and to work with our community to see to it that the things that make a healthy community are present, not just that developers and landlords are making money. That's obviously important to an economy, but there are nuanced things.
Are there any conflicts inherent in being a landlord and a community church downtown at the same time?
Well, we're not really landlords right now, so...
Well, you're landowners.
We're landowners. No, I don't think so. I haven't seen that. We're landowners, and we use our resources for the common good. We're a nonprofit, so we haven't experienced any. In fact, you know, it's a parking lot right now. We're seeking to develop it into a church and a, you know, mixed-use project housing. Now we're hearing about hotels. So if we can do that, that will even expand our ability to have space. In South Park particularly, there's no public meeting space. There's none. And so if you want to have, for instance, a Girl Scout meeting, which we hope everyone knows there is a Girl Scout troop forming in downtown Los Angeles, the fabulous Ginny Brideau. Many of downtown people know her. And there are already 53 girls. And they are, you know, 1010 Development Corporation has space, and they're sort of shoehorned into every nook and cranny of that space. But we are, you know, we know as a church, if we have a large meeting space, we will worship in it on Sunday mornings. And for the rest of the week, we hope it will host these community events.
That's wonderful. What has it been like to negotiate with developers on that parking lot?
Well, it's been interesting for me because the church has been in downtown, you know, all these many years. And we have a long view. We've inherited this property from the people who came before us. It's a legacy to us. We don't own it. And we see it as a legacy to leave for the future. Whereas a developer has more of a short-term idea of things. They'd like to, you know, they'd like to build it, flip it, and go. And I think that that definitely has a place in the world, but our view is different. So it's not, it's not a mission match exactly. So we know that we are looking for, and we're in some preliminary talks with some developers who have this almost philanthropic heart. They will make money. They won't make as much money as they might if they were flipping it. But if they are willing to build something that they stay in for the long term, they'll make their money back plus. So we were actually, in 2008, we were on our way to a mixed-use housing plus a church, and it was looking really good. And then, as you know, the economy sank, and there were no loans being made, and everything kind of fell apart. But we feel like we dodged a bullet because we didn't have a deal in place or a hole in the ground when everything tanked. Like, we just, it was just a deal being made. So now we're kind of back to that table, you know, a sign of the health of the economy, that we're back to the table and we're talking with various developers. And we think people get what we want, what we need. So we're just looking for that particular partner who is willing to say that this is a unique thing because there will be a church as part of this development. But we see the common good and we see the way it benefits us. So
Is parking worth more than everything downtown, even for your congregation members?
No. No, it isn't. Not for us. I mean, at this point, if we had a church on that land, we would be exempt from property taxes. But because it's just a flat, and I have to say, it was never the plan to have a parking lot there, and it's still not the plan. It just has happened that way. That when they tore down the original building, they had plans to rebuild, and then they just couldn't get the cash to build. So for us, the parking costs us an enormous amount of money every year in property taxes, and we have to cover that. So, and we have to rent other space that we would normally own. We have to cover that. So for us, it's kind of a wash. We'd rather have a church and a space. And we do have a church, and I just want to say to people who are looking for us, people come to try to find us, and they don't see a church building. It's hard for them to figure out that we're in the multipurpose room next door, which is at the back of the building. So we're improving our signage, but I just want people to know if they want to find us, we're a progressive church. We have so many different diversities in the church, racial, ethnic diversities, income diversities, age diversities. We've got lots of kids. We love babies and kids and parents, and we love, we have lots of gay folk who come to our church, who are comfortable, full part of our church. We don't believe in our congregation, as others might, that being gay is something, means something's wrong with you. We celebrate God's diversity, and we have so many wonderful, loving people. So if you're looking for us...
why don't you tell us where the church is located?
So it's 1020 South Flower, on the corner of Flower and Olympic. But 1020 South Flower is the Via Flores Senior. It's an apartment building. And then you just enter at the back of the building. There's a gate. There's an alleyway. It's not a scary alley. It's actually called Pembroke Lane. It's a lane, not an alley. Come down the lane and into the gate, and you'll see that's where we are on Sunday mornings.
So Sandy's church is located in an area of intense land speculation, and things are flipping faster than hotcakes on a grill. There's a large number of sites under escrow right in your neighborhood.
That's right.
Now, is this cycle, this land cycle, different than the others that you've seen? Are we finally there with downtown becoming something new that it was not before? Is that your experience? I know you're not a developer.
I'm not a developer, and it's interesting because I think I would go to you for land cycle advice. But what I would say is I came in 05. And that was before anything was built, but it was all entitled. And now everything is, those projects are built. But people are a little more cautious now than they were, you know, in the go-go years of 05 to 07. So everyone has the sense that even though things seem to be getting better, they could fall. So there's a sense of urgency that I don't think I saw in 05.
And some of that urgency is coming from unresolved issues downtown that we might want to touch on briefly. Well, we're way off our agenda here, but I wanted to ask you if you see any equity issues downtown, unresolved major equity issues in our community.
When you say equity, do you mean equality issues?
Right, social justice issues that are emerging.
Absolutely. So let's start with the kids. Let's start with them. I don't care what your income level is, your race, your education level. When people were thinking of developing downtown Los Angeles, they certainly were not thinking about children. It just wasn't even a question. And I remember in 05 when I first came, I said, well, where are the kids? And people said, there are no kids. And I went online and I did a demographic search, and I found out that there were 400 school-aged kids within a half-mile radius of our church property. 400 kids, that's a lot of kids. So there weren't the infrastructure needed for kids, childcare, daycare, parks, those kinds of things were not being developed, or weren't thought of. And now sort of there's this sort of backfilling, which is lovely. We've had lots of new park space, renovated park space, pocket park space. Grand Hope Park is near us, which is a private park. It's right. Not a public park, but it has a wonderful play area. And I think a lot of families love that, but you can't have a birthday party in that park. You have to go through FITM, the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising, who basically watches over it. And they're not very happy about, like, people bringing food and birthday cakes and so forth. Like, it's not a public park.
That's a shame, because the public resources were used to build it. And that the last case, I think, of eminent domain being used to acquire property downtown. And it was done on the behalf of FITM.
Well, it may be. I know that 1010 Development Corporation is part of the owner. So, as far as you know, it being for the good of the residents, it is. But it's not a public park in the same way as other public spaces are public. So it's a beautiful park, though, and I have spent many happy hours there myself. And I know a lot of kids use that playground. So that's one example of schools. The things you need when you have children, that's one way in which there's an equity issue. And obviously, we have a huge disconnect around homelessness and what to do around homelessness.
Yes, that's we're going to concentrate a little bit more on that next week when Jan Perry is our guest. But I wanted to ask you, you know, some time ago, Gloria Molina tried to establish facilities throughout the county to take care and provide for the homeless. And Jan Perry also supported that, but it was shot down by L.A. County, by the county supervisors. Do you think, you know, without putting yourself out on the limb, was that a mistake? Should all the communities in Los Angeles really have facilities to help the homeless, to avoid concentrating downtown with the resultant concentration of the drug trade and so on?
I mean, absolutely. First, I think that when we have the homeless population is much, much larger than what we see in downtown. So there are people who are homeless in their cars. Recently, a member of Congress said that if you have a car, you shouldn't have food stamps. But for some people, a car is where they live, so it doesn't really make sense. So, you know, the issues of poverty and the inability to participate in society are complex, incredibly complicated. And some of them have to do with poverty. Some of them have to do with post-traumatic stress of returning veterans. Some of them, and that's male and female, by the way. Some of them have to do with mental illness, drug addiction. And so what happens, it isn't that the homeless people are drug traders. It's that they are a vulnerable population and a sure marketplace. So it is something you have to think about when you are locating a homeless resource. You want to make sure if people are unhoused that they have a continuum of care, they have a variety of services, and that there is a way to bring people from point A to point B to point C. Now, that said, there are always going to be folks who are unable to follow that continuum. Maybe their mental faculties just don't allow it. So we as a society need compassionate ways to address that. And one of the ways should be that you don't have to travel far, far, far from your community of origin in order to find those services or in order to live. We just haven't cracked that nut yet. It, as a society, it's an incredibly expensive thing. Some of the most well-funded downtown missions that are the most effective can really only help, you know, 60, 80 people a year in an intensive program of rehabilitation. So to make that all the job of a few missions in one particular area doesn't make sense. But on the other hand, I know people are concerned about, like, not in my backyard. They don't want...
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's particularly prevalent in Los Angeles, where there are so many different communities.
Right.
When you talk about L.A., you're talking about, I don't know, how many different cities,
Yeah. How
many different jurisdictions, and you cannot park, never mind setting up a homeless facility, you can't park in these neighborhoods. There's such a sense of exclusion that if you have a party in some places on the west side, you have to get approval and print up little parking passes to put on people's cars.
Yes, that's part
of it. Is that a big part of our problem, the NIMBYism, or is it these other issues you raise?
I think it's both. And I think that there's a real issue of people want quiet enjoyment of their homes, you know, that's for sure. Like in our neighborhood, we're close where the church house is, and I live in the church property, and it's 4 miles west of downtown. We live near a big insurance company, and their employees parked all over our neighborhood. And we didn't mind, but our neighbors did. So they made it that you can't park because they would come home with their groceries or whatever, and there'd be nowhere to park. So they thought, you know, the insurance company didn't provide parking. That's a real issue. But I think what solves problems in communities is when people come together to talk to each other. That, I think, is what solves problems because everybody has misconceptions and nobody really knows the other person's sensibilities. We don't really know what people are worried about. We know overall what they're worried about and we have labels for each other about that. But I think when people have understanding and input, and it takes a while to move the needle, if you want to do something quickly, you're going to have conflict. But if you're willing to walk down the road of long discussions, you may have people who strongly disagree, and at the end of your time, they still will strongly disagree, but you will have moved the needle and you will have figured out more about what's workable. And I'm not sure that the politicians are the ones who should be doing that work. I think we should be the ones doing that work with each other so that when a problem, a crisis arises, we have relationships with each other that allows us to listen to each other instead of just be mad at each other. For instance, this radio show, Ed, I think is going to be one of those things for downtown. You're going to be able to have people on who know each other because downtown's kind of a small town and we kind of all know each other and Facebook and so forth. And we're working very hard, I think, to some of us, many of us, to establish the kinds of relationships across divisions that allow us to address these issues when they come up.
Well, I think that is wonderful, your approach. And talking about like slow, long-term changes, I'm really fascinated with, it's a grouping called the Christian Left, and I have them on my Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And I just think that they might be the key to the future of this country and long-term changes that, you know, I'm just so interested in them, probably even more so since I was lost on the desert and there were so many Christians praying for me, not just Jews. I think I got more involved emotionally in the fact that, you know, there's like 100 times the number of Christians here as there are Jews. And the changes that are going to come in the Christian community, in my humble opinion. Are you part of that grouping? Would you say there's a grouping of progressive churches that come under the Christian Left? And is it organizational or is it just an individual happenstance?
That's a very good question. As a United Methodist, we have people on all sides of the political spectrum. But as a person, I am a progressive. I wasn't raised in a Christian church. I'm not a lifelong Methodist at all. I became a Methodist because I was drawn to the social justice aspects of the denomination. And we are, my colleagues that are sort of more progressively minded, more we work more interfaith. I think that's really the answer to me is not, I think that the conservative Christians, and I'm not talking about my friends, my beloved friends who disagree with me. I'm talking about the people who are politically right and who, on the right wing, I mean, politically on the right wing, and who use their faith as justification for their beliefs, their political beliefs. That's not as big a number as the popular press would have you believe. For instance, when the Supreme Court made their decision on same-sex marriage, Wolf Blitzer had on someone from a very right-wing, almost a fringe right-wing organization, and that was the Christian voice, and he kept speaking for Christians. And there's a majority of us, I think, slightly more than half of us, most of us are younger. I'm not in the younger group, but many are younger.
You are to me.
I guess it's a perspective. But who don't see homosexuality in the same way as a lot of people traditionally have. So, and we have a firm reading of the Bible that gives us that sensibility. And anyway, the Bible's much more severe on divorce, and we manage to incorporate the concept of divorce and people of sacred worth. So in our church, we have people who've been divorced and remarried, pastors who've been divorced and remarried, and we never make an issue of that. And so we understand that that sometimes people focus on things like homosexuality or sexuality because we're uncomfortable with what the verses that say not to exploit the poor. Like, I'm not gay, so that's never going to affect me. I could judge other people all the time if I make a rule about not being gay. But if I make a rule about not exploiting the poor, that affects everything I do all day long and challenges me. So what I hope...
Can you explain that again, the difference between those two things?
Sure. So if I am a member of a group who says that being gay is not okay, and there are lots of groups who say that, that most of us aren't gay. So what is not okay is other people. I'm okay because I'm never going to be gay, right? But if I am part of a group that exploits the poor, well... My lifestyle as a U.S. American, I can't buy a shirt in a store, no matter how nice the store. with a guarantee that somebody wasn't exploited to make that shirt for me. And if I buy a discount shirt, I'm fond of a bargain. How did I get a shirt for $5 that was made across the world, that came to me on a boat, that got driven to the store? I mean, $5 doesn't even pay the minimum wage for the hour of the person who rang it up for me. So I have to understand that my lifestyle, I have a cell phone that has conflict minerals. It's made of minerals where people are dying, and, you know, in order to mine these things. And I get in a car and I pump it up full of gas. Who's profiting from that petroleum? Is it some person who's going to, use those profits against my country? Like, every decision I make economically has implications that I don't want to think about. And that is the hardest thing, I think, as Christians or as people of faith or as anyone who cares about the world, to live a life that is completely free of exploiting the poor. It's almost impossible to do.
Yes, I think the Pope, is it Pope Francis?
Pope Francis.
He came out and said those garment factories located in Bangladesh are really slave labor.
They are, but
and
even...
I'm encouraged by his sentiment.
They are, but think about it. We want cheap vegetables. So now we're back to the wall again. We want cheap vegetables. We don't want to pay people what it really costs for them to live. A living wage might be $12 to $15 an hour. We'd rather pay, 50 cents a bushel or whatever. We don't really want to pay people, we don't want to pay for things that cost that much. So we have all this low wage labor. In the state of California, farm work is exempt from labor laws that govern everything else. And farm work was specifically exempted because we know it's done by migrant workers, by really not slaves per se, but virtual slaves. So the reality is that we have not figured out in this country since the founding of it, since the 1600s when slaves first arrived, not figured out how to do things for the cost that they really are. So,
wow, she's even more progressive than I am. We better get her out of here.
I'm challenged by that. Are we almost done with the show?
No,
I'm gonna let
I
you
wanted
close.
To ask you.
Yeah.
I love where you're going, and I want to ask you, there's a movement afoot, which is an environmental and social justice movement, and the... It's a Christian left movement, mm-hmm. and their main question is, what would Jesus do?
Well,
is that the focus of what you're getting to here?
That's a big question. I'll try to answer it in a few minutes.
I have 2.5 minutes.
Well, 30 seconds.
No.
for the people that are listening, I think all of us needs to think about who we harm by our choices, each and every one of us. And that's a big question, and it takes a big amount of time. Most of us don't have that kind of time. Most people are doing their best to get up for work and get to their jobs and get their kids fed and get their car washed. I mean, most of us are so drawn up into our lives. So I guess what I would say is, in order to make the world a better place, we're going to have to figure out how to slow down and how to be together more, and how to listen to each other more deeply, and how, to love and respect each other. That's what we're going to have to do. That doesn't happen naturally, given the pace of our lives. We have to make time and space. So for me, it happens at church. For me, I spend that time with people I know who know me. We don't agree on everything, but we've at least said we're going to come together and try to love each other. And then we're going to try to do things that make a difference. But we can't point the finger outside and say other people do it. We have to be the ones. We are the ones. We are the ones who have to, racism, how do I benefit from racism, and how do I change? How do I move the needle toward justice? How do I benefit from the exploiting the poor, and how do I move the needle toward justice?
Well, you can see why Sandy Richards of the United Methodist Church is our first guest on this show, because we want to establish a deeper context. We don't want to hear the usual baloney from our guests, and that's why she's number one. I really want to thank her so much for coming in here today and answering these questions, which, that's really not easy to put that much thought into these issues that are affecting California, Los Angeles, and downtown. And I couldn't think of a better start than her comments here today.
It's been
unless I could have had a few jokes to tell, that might have been
poetry next time, Ed. We all That's want right. poetry. Thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you.
All the wayward wind is a restless